Good afternoon and welcome to the Evolution Seminar Series. Today, our last speaker. So this is the end of this series, but we will continue next semester. We hope to see you here again at the same time, same day, with new speakers, all new set of speakers. But for today, we have Professor Gary Lupien. He's an assistant professor at the Department of Psychology, and his lab research revolves around where language and human cognitive processes meet. So today he's going to give us a talk about the linguistic hypothesis.
Okay, thank you all for coming. I'll tell you about one line of research that I and my collaborator, Rick Dale, have been involved in, trying to understand a very sort of simple but tricky question that's an old one, which is, why are there so many languages? There are, depending on how you count, about 7,000 languages in the world. And why are them so complicated? Why are some of them so complicated? Okay. This question, people have been interested in this since biblical times, right? And it's sort of interesting that while one might expect that a religion would have a sort of story about why are there people, why are there animals, it's interesting that this question of why do people speak different languages has interested people, you know, for thousands of years, and it was important enough to warrant sort of having a religious narrative created around it. Now, just how different are these languages? So, of course, everyone knows that languages sound different. There are no speakers here, but if everyone is really quiet, maybe you can hear this from my laptop speakers. So this is a language spoken by quite a few people in South Africa. It's Xhosa. And along with related languages, this one sounds particularly quite different because it includes click sounds. So let's see if it works. Now, the click sounds in this language are analogous to other consonants, but this is the sort of diversity that one might not expect if all one is familiar is with languages spoken in Europe, for example. One kind of way to dodge the question of why there are so many languages is to hypothesize that while there are languages, different languages in that, you know, we can't understand someone who speaks Spanish, we don't speak Spanish, the differences are somehow superficial. And if you just look at a deeper level of analysis, the differences disappear. So this is what Steve Pinker has in mind when, in quoting Chomsky, he refers to this idea of, you know, if you just look at a deeper level of analysis, then these differences that we observe will disappear. They're just superficial. And this fails. This is just straight up wrong. Whenever people have tried to find these kinds of linguistic universals, they've continuously failed. So, for example, various proposed universals, like all languages have verb and or noun affixes, so prefixes or suffixes. For example, we can inflect walk by adding D, inflecting it in the past tense. Many languages don't do this. Syntactic recursion has been in the literature recently with reports of languages that don't use it as well, not universal. Basic word classes, nouns, verbs, adverbs, adjectives, surely something so basic would be universal to all human languages. It turns out that it's not. And the reality is, in this eerie way, it resembles a short story by Borges, where he describes this alien language in which all words function in the same way. This sort of the noun and verbs blend. So there's no word and noun moon, but there's just everything is a kind of verb. And in fact, there are languages like this. Even at the sort of surface level, all languages have vowels and consonants, surely. Well, there are some exceptions, right? So sign languages are an obvious case where we can transpose language into a whole different modality and it works just fine. But even in the spoken modality, in the vocal modality, there are ways to transpose spoken language into something that is not, does not resemble normal consonant vowel structure. So this is a whistled form of Spanish spoken on the Canary Islands, and I'll get into why the Canary Islands and why it's not a coincidence that you find this kind of system in this ecological environment. So it's possible to have conversations in this across several miles, and the language is right now being taught in schools to kids because it was dying out, but the government is sort of making efforts to keep it alive. Also, just to give you, before getting into data and such, to give you just a sense of the differences in certain kinds of complexity between languages. So consider the case of demonstrative systems. So this refers to words like this, that, here, there, ways to refer to where something is in the environment, in comparison to the sort of simple English system, this, that, here, there. Here's one that's considerably more complex. In this language, just as you can in English, you can differentiate between here, close to you, there, farther from you. But we can further specify, and this is all in the grammar of the language, whether the there is indoors or outdoors, whether it's above or below you. And this is all duplicated from the perspective of the listener. So you can refer to something being close to you, you can refer to something being close to the listener, far from the listener, indoors relative to where the listener is, above relative to you, above relative to them. And as a result, you can very precisely describe where something is with relation to a particular object without making reference to other objects in the environment. And I'll come back to this, this will become important. Right, so we can, I mean, these sorts of comparisons are a bit silly, you can't really count the number of words to say something in a given language, but, you know, just to give you a sense of the kind of combinatorial explosion that this system produces, you know, you have 88 ways to describe where something is just using these this terminology, right? Now, even kind of moving closer to home, if we compare English to other European languages, English turns out to be quite a bit simpler. So in, for instance, looking at just the Germanic languages, so we have German, Dutch, Yiddish, Frisian, I think this is Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, and so on. The slide isn't really coming out, but in ways in which these languages differ at the grammatical level, English fails to make most of the distinctions that these other languages make. And so here's one example from directional, this line, directional adverbs. So Old English used to differentiate between two forms of where the location, and where the directional sense, where are you going, and where are the keys. These are different words, that different meanings that we collapse in English. It didn't used to be this way, and in German it still isn't. Okay, and I'll come back to explaining why this is. Okay, so languages really are different inside and out. Every attempt to try to find true universals has failed. Okay, and so when faced with this kind of diversity, we can ask the natural question of why does it exist? And if we were faced with this situation in the biological realm, what might we want to ask, right? Well, here, why are there different kinds of birds, right? Why are their beaks different? right? The answer is that we can analyze diversity in terms of adaptations to an environment, right? It's not just random diversity, it's principled. There is randomness, of course, as well, but it's principled and systematic, and we can understand why things are the way they are by appealing to the fit of these different organisms to some aspects of their environment, right? And so the proposal is that languages are like that, right? That languages also adapt to the environment. And just as we can build linguistic trees, biological trees, phylogenetic trees, trying to understand common ancestors and what sorts of environmental variation may have led, it's an empirical question, may have led to these kinds of morphological differences, we can build linguistic trees and ask the same kinds of questions. Okay. The idea that languages and cultures more broadly adapt to the environment is not new, but interestingly has not really been asked in this domain, right? And so if you find, for example, that people in India and people in Norway eat different things and you ask why, you know, the first place where you might want to look is, well, what food sources are available? How is the diet? How are the cooking practices? How are food storage practices being constrained by, say, the availability of food sources, right? And in an analogous way, we can ask the same question of languages, but for various reasons, people have not really done that. Okay? And one of those reasons is that, unlike in the biological realm, unlike in the case of animals, it's really kind of tricky to figure out what variation is relevant and on what level of analysis one should study this. So in trying to relate these two domains, we need to establish, first, what linguistic variation we should look at. Second, what environmental variation is relevant. And what are the mechanisms by which languages may adapt to the environment? Okay. So starting with the first, there are a number of places to start. But one very sort of easy to analyze and very old distinction that people have made when looking at different languages is the level of morphological complexity. And so just to give you a sense of what that means, so let's compare the verb morphology, so how verbs change in English. Really simple, we can take a stem and inflect it into the past tense. You can go from walk to walked, and it also inflects for person. Right, I walk, he walks. So this is referred to as inflectional morphology. There's also derivational morphology, things like, you know, from going from lease to lessee, things like that. Right? So making nouns into verbs and so on. Looking at just the inflectional morphology, this is the situation we have in another language, in Georgian. Right, if you think. Thought that Latin inflectional system was complicated, you know, this is way, way more so, right? So there's just a lot more packed into the verb itself, and people refer to this distinction also as light verbs and heavy verbs. It's not that you can say things in Georgian that you can't say in English, it just takes a lot of different words in English, but you can pack it all into a single word in Georgian, and moreover, the meaning, you can change the meaning of the word quite dramatically by prefixing it with different sort of what are called preverbs, right? So this is all the same root, but it changes depending on what's attached to it. And in a language like English, you don't really have this. You would just use different words altogether. If you've heard of also polysynthetic languages like Eskimo that you know, do things like this. So this is another Native American language, Cayuga, right, where this is all a single word. Okay? And there is a root there, potatoes, and then everything else is just attached to it to create synthetically the whole meaning. Right? People have also kind of drew analogies between these kinds of languages and languages that people are more familiar with, as the difference between a chemical compound and a mixture, right? Where in a mixture, the individual particles retain their properties, the individual components. Okay, so I'm going to start by looking at this kind of linguistic variation, and then we'll branch out into some other domains. Environmental variation. What might we look at? So in the case of Galapagos finches, right, you might look at, well, what food sources are they specializing in? What kind of, are they, you know, pecking at nuts on the ground? Are they foraging at the top of the tree? What are their niches? Right? Similarly, we can ask, what are the niches in which languages exist? And it may surprise people that not only are there, that there are about 7,000 languages, but that half of the languages are spoken by fewer than 7,000 speakers. Many of these languages are in trouble, they're going extinct, but many are not. And they're spoken also over fairly small areas. This is the median area over which a language is spoken, about the size of the San Diego area, the size of Luxembourg, the greater San Diego area. And the more normal situation of languages is not like English, spoken by hundreds of millions of people on every continent, but like this. This is a piece of coast of Papua New Guinea on which we overlaid language boundaries. You can't really map language boundaries very cleanly, but these are the data that are available. Okay. In many of these cases, people literally know everyone who speaks their language. Okay. This is a very different situation from the demographic environment in which other languages are operating in. Okay, so as a kind of rough proxy of this, we can use just the population. How many people speak a language? There are fairly good numbers available for this, so we can use this as a measure of sort of a, what I'll refer to as exotericity of the language. It's also very closely correlated with the number of non-native speakers. A language spoken by a few thousand people is very unlikely to have any non-native speakers. A language spoken by millions and millions of people almost invariably has non-native learners, just because the language can't really spread very much without running into other languages and having people learning it. There are exceptions. So Japanese is an interesting case of a language that's spoken by about 100 million people, and about 98% or so of speakers of Japanese are ethnically Japanese, right? But that's not, that's sort of an outlier. Okay, so we can define this continuum between language and spoken in a more esoteric niche, which refers to these small socially cohesive populations, few non-native speakers. They tend to be concentrated in small areas. And on the other side, exoteric communities with large, diverse speaking populations, many non-native speakers spread over a large area. Okay, so just as a start, there are other important differences. Finally, what are the mechanisms by which languages adapt? So language is transmitted culturally, right? There are some genetic adaptations for the capacity to learn languages. If you raise a non-human animal in a human environment, they are not going to learn language. Interestingly, they will learn some things that they don't learn in the wild. But there are certain differences that are biological that allow people to learn languages. These differences might actually be very, very small, and they certainly don't encode anything specific to learning a particular language, right? And so they, all of language structure is being transmitted culturally, right? So this means that all languages are necessarily constrained by what infants can learn. If there's something that is not learnable, not easily learnable by an infant, it cannot propagate, right? So all languages have this factor that constrains them. But interestingly, not all languages have to be learned by adults, right? So all languages have these guys as a constraint, not all languages have these guys as a constraint. Right, so yes, just because Chomsky can't learn the particular distinction doesn't mean that languages can't have it. So this now introduces an interesting possibility that as a language spreads and is under a constraint and is being learned by non-native speakers, insofar as adults are bad at certain aspects of language learning, they are in imposing an additional set of constraints. And this is not a new idea. So Peter Trudgill, a historical linguist, has talked about it for a while. But there was no data for this up until recently. Right, and so basically what he's saying is that in whatever ways adults are lousy language learners, as a language is being learned by adults, they will induce certain changes in the language. And introducing adult learners into a population also affects what children are learning. Because children are, it depends on the community, but children are getting most of their input from adults, right? And so this kind of situation is actually quite common. So here's a multilingual environment in Senegal where you have children learning Bambara, which is a local language that's being kind of used as a lingua franca, but in the community. But the parents, in this case, Bambara is the native language only of 19% of the mothers, 16% of the fathers, right? In most cases, the language, they have other native languages. So the kids are getting input from non-native speakers, essentially. So even though they might be able to learn Bambara in all of its complexity, they're getting, there's a restriction being placed on their input. So that's what's referred to as this restricted input, right? And so just introducing adults, and we have, if there's time, I can get into the sort of mathematical modeling of this, but introducing adults into a population propagates and affects language learning by everyone. Okay, so morphological complexity, exotericity, and restricted input. What happens when we put all of these together and ask the question whether languages are adapting to their environments? Okay, so what we, as a start, need to do is relate these two domains. So we know that some languages have more speakers. They're spoken over a larger area. We know that some languages have more complex morphology. Do these domains correlate? Okay, and so that's the hypothesis, that there is a relationship here. And specifically, languages with more speakers will, over time, adapt to this exoteric niche by essentially becoming easier to learn by adults. Okay. This kind of analysis on a large scale wasn't possible until recently with the advent of the World Atlas of Language Structures, which combined descriptive grammars from hundreds of field linguists on several thousand languages. And using this and combining it with other sources that, for instance, have population estimates, geographic coverage of different languages, we can ask the following kinds of questions. Right, so one of the variables in the atlas refers to how many different categories verbs in the language can inflect into, so just a basic measure of verb morphology. So this is what reflects the distinction here. So here's a subset of that data with some characteristic languages in each group. You can see that there is a relationship here. Languages spoken by fewer people tend to have greater greater verb morphology. And we can control for various things. I can get into it later, but languages are not independent from one another, so you can't. There's a problem in doing any kind of cross-cultural analysis where you have to overcome this non-independence. So we do this with Monte Carlo shuffling and also controlling for language family, looking within language families. Talk more about it if people are interested. At the level of language families as well, so these are Indo-European languages. Log population spoken on average by many people. Fairly simple verb morphology. And you find similar kinds of patterns in pretty much every morphological domain that we looked at. I'll give you a few examples: possession, evidentiality, and tense. So possession, there are different kinds of possession of languages expressed, and just like the case of where are you going and where are the keys, there are different meanings that may be subsumed by the same grammatical device. So in English, we use apostrophe S to signal all sorts of possession, but that's not always the case. So for example, here's an instance of a grammatical distinction between alienable and inalienable possession. So my milk, you have to distinguish between, is it milk that you bought or is it milk that you produced? Okay. And there are other kinds of distinctions languages make, and the likelihood that they make these distinctions in the grammar is again correlated with the population. It's also correlated, you can get additional predictive power by including things like population density, geographic spread, the degree to which a language contacts other languages. Future tense, again, there are ways of expressing tenses, future, past, so on, grammatically or lexically. Right? You could say, an example would be, I went yesterday, right, versus I go, you could say yesterday if you want. In the case of future tense, some languages use inflectional future tense, others don't. Again, it correlates with population. Another domain is evidentiality. So this refers to distinctions in that some languages make in how you've come to know something. So for example, a class of evidentials of, where you can't just say the meat is charring. You have to specify that you know this by the sound that it makes, or the smell, right? Or that someone told you that the meat is charring. So you have to specify grammatically the state of knowledge. Okay, and there are also these grammatical quotatives that English is at present is in the process of incorporating. And so you find, just in the last 10, 20 years, an increase in people saying things like, he went like, and then quoting them. So that like in there is having this grammatical function of a quotative. But there are languages in which this is really deeply built into the grammar. The likelihood that it is again correlated with population. So we can put a lot of these measures together and get an overall complexity score, and there is a very strong relationship with these demographic factors, especially population. And so the more people there are that speak a language, the more non-native learners that language has, the simpler its grammar in this respect. Okay. So we can ask a further question of why is there this complexity to begin with? Right? Why aren't all languages like English? And a common explanation for this is that it just is. As long as kids can learn it, it accumulates over time, it's just basically baggage, right? It just accretes historically. And that may be the case, but if one is faced with complexity, especially very systematic, non-random complexity, one would like to have a functional explanation for it. So the kind of explanation we've been pursuing currently is that just like these languages with simpler morphologies are adapting to be easier for adults to learn, so languages with more complex morphology may reflect an adaptation for child learning. So in essence, maybe the complexity, what is to us, you know, looking from an adult perspective, appears complex and unnecessary, is actually improving child learning. And so I'll briefly talk about some kind of, well, support of this as a first pass. With every increase in morphological specification, there is an increase in redundancy. Okay, and this is what Mark Twain was talking about when he has an essay, something like the horrible German language, where he is talking about grammatical gender, right? Right, and commenting on this, you know, redundancy, right? That grammatical gender, and this is also true of other things, agreement. Right? Why do we inflect walk when you say he walks, you know, I walk? You already know that it's he, you just said it. Why change the verb? It's redundant. Right? And it gets worse, right? So here's grammatical gender marking, you know, cubed, right? So table here in the sentence is marked as being masculine three separate times, right? Why, right? What purpose is this serving? So as a first pass, what we try to do is to first see whether there is a relationship between this kind of redundancy and environmental variation. So we did two kinds of analyses. First, we took a document that's been translated into lots of languages, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's actually the most translated document. We just took about 100 languages that it's been translated into that use the Roman alphabet. Okay, and we zipped them. Okay, we took the text files and we zipped the text files. And if you know anything about how zip works, right, is it's a very simple but robust redundancy removing device, right? It's a lossless form of compression that takes out repeated strings and replaces them with shorter codes. So the more repetition there is, the better your file will compress. Okay? And when we looked at the degree to which these different files compress, you get a relationship. Okay? So the more people there are that speak a language, the worse the file compresses. Okay, so this is the compressibility ratio. Okay. So put another way, the languages with most speakers are, this is backwards. Yeah. Languages with fewest speakers are most compressible. Okay. So we can hypothesize, and this is an empirical question, that this difference in redundancy is perhaps helping kids learn. And this is actually a difficult empirical question to test because you really can't test it in the lab. Any language task you come up with that can be done in the lab, if you compare adult learning and child learning, the adults are going to do better. Kids do better in the long run, but you know, any kind of manageable tasks. You can use artificial grammar learning kinds of tasks that require subjects to learn many languages. Adults are going to, the short term, outperform the kids. Okay, we can do a similar kind of analysis by quantifying surprisal. The intuition here is that, you know, if you get the words the dog, right, you can with some probability predict what the next word is, right? So there's some probability that the next word is, barks, a lower probability cried and catapulted, right? They're all possible, but unlikely. And so we can analyze, we can take large corpora of text in different languages and see whether we get a better ability to predict what the next word is, right? Again, as a function of population, okay? And it's a simple n-gram model where you just scan the text with some window and given the word W, so with word W given a context C, what is the likelihood, right, the next word? And what we find is there's a strong relationship. So these are, it's limited to the languages for which for which Google published their n-gram corpus. And what you find is that languages spoken by more people have greater surprisal values, so they are less predictable. So this is, again, reflecting a kind of efficiency, but from the point of view of learnability, it's perhaps posing a challenge. So the idea here is that adults are, on the whole, much better at basically figuring out what the person means to say, figuring it out from the context, from various extra-linguistic cues. So by packaging more information into language, making it redundant and predictable, the idea is that this is perhaps helping kids learn. Okay, there's more to it, and I can go into it in more details later, but I wanted to really quickly mention another kind of linguistic diversity that we're now analyzing and trying to relate to environmental differences, which has to do with these kinds of ecological effects on language. So these are the Canary Islands, and this is just another bit of that video with the whistle language. Funerals, romanias or pilgrimages, weddings and baptisms. It is not a language created for the intimate. It is for the public, for what must be said out loud and can be heard by all. Okay, so the environment in which this and other whistling-type languages have formed looks something like this, right? So you don't find people developing a whistled form of a language in a forest, okay? It wouldn't be very useful, right? Here, you have a combination of open spaces, right, and it's difficult to get from here to here, right? So there is a kind of pressure to have a system, an environment where you have the open spaces, you can transmit the sounds, certain kinds of sounds, like whistles, particularly effectively. Right? So environments are, of course, not just We can look at not just the socio-demographic kind of differences, but also at these kinds of ecological differences. And one analysis that we've been looking at is relates to the sparsity of the environment. So languages that have these kinds of systems, the original linguists describing them, have noticed that you don't just find them anywhere. you tend to find them, and this is just anecdotal at the time, but you tend to find them in places like this, right? And so Denny, the person who originally described this system of demonstratives of that language, made the following observation. So perhaps in a natural environment, non-human spaces, one way to relate space to human activity is to use deictic spatial concepts to center space on the speaker or other participants, right? In a man-made environment, right, you can say things like across the street, next to the mailbox. You can't really say next to the mailbox if there are no mailboxes, right? And so what we've been doing is trying to see if there is, in fact, statistical evidence for these kinds of relationships. Unfortunately, there are now sources available that we can combine and analyze. One of them is the standard cross-cultural sample, which codes for the biome in which a language is spoken. And so in the sample, there are 20 languages that are spoken in these sort of open, you know, tundra-like environments. And the very first analysis we ran, just looking at very coarse analysis of complexity of these kinds of systems, of demonstratives, we find that there's a relationship there such that languages spoken in the most sparse biome in the tundra, in fact, statistically have more complex demonstratives, these languages spoken in different families. Another kind of variation that, again, has been noted by people but not really analyzed in a rigorous way refers to, again, how people talk about space, but now not just with one object relative to another, but on a larger scale. So the systems used to refer to, you know, go this way, right? Go that way, go to the right, go north, and so on. There are to put it bluntly, in about a third of the world's languages, you can't say the spoon is to the right of the fork. There are words for right and left to refer to hands, things like strong, weak, but they're not extended to space. You don't talk about space in an egocentric way. Instead, you use a combination of an absolute coordinate system, so the fork is north of the plate, south of the plate, it's not necessarily magnetic, or you use this sort of environment-centered uphill-downhill, where with reference to the physical environment outside, in combination with an object reference frame. So for a plate, that wouldn't make much sense, but you can say essentially at the head of the tree, where the head of the tree refers to the tree, the side that has moss growing on it, for example. So we have this kind of variation, and we also have interesting variation in the cognitive abilities of different populations with respect to navigation. So just to give you a sense of what this variation looks like, so here's some data from a homing pigeon after a hooded displacement. So these pigeons are taken, their hoods put over, heads, they're driven in a truck, in this case 66 kilometers, they're then released, and they're all actually systematically off, so this is the direction they should fly in, they all make it back, but they have a pretty good sense, and they will correct as they fly, they have a pretty good sense of where home is, right? Here's a comparison of British hikers after a 1 kilometer hike on a trail, and they have to point back to the direction in which they started. Okay, not so good. Okay, and so from this one might conclude, well, okay, people are just bad at navigating. People, you know, can't sense magnetic field gradients the way pigeons can. But actually, that's not entirely true. So here's a case of an Australian Aboriginal population pointing in a desert to various landmarks up to 300 kilometers away after being, you know, spun around, okay? Here's another population. This is an African Bushman sample. And perhaps not surprisingly, the populations that can do this, right, tend to have languages and speak languages that use these kinds of systems of directional terms. Right? So, and it's not just directional terms, you also have, right, so in this case, you can't talk about, you know, something being to the right of something, to the left of something. You can't say take the next right, right? You have to know which way the person is facing. So you're essentially running a mental compass every time you're talking about where something is in relation to something else. Now, when you see, you know, is it just any environment in which these kinds of systems develop? The answer is no. So this is case of a community near the Himalayas, right? You can imagine that the Himalayas form a constant kind of reference point, right? Such that it's extremely salient. And even when people are indoors, even when it's dark, they can't see the mountains, right? They know where the mountains are. You also get this in island communities where, regardless of where you are on the island, right, you know which way is toward the ocean and which way is inward into the island. So you have cases, of course, with, you know, communities where there are prevailing winds, so there are constant reinforcements, which you don't get in communities like this. So the another kind of anecdotal case. So the point here is that we're seeing a kind of interaction between the ecological environment, linguistic differences that emerge based on the environmental differences, and the cognitive consequences of some of these differences. So it's not the case that the only way to become a good navigator is to speak a language that has this kind of terminology, but every speaker of this language has to have a good sense of direction, in essence, right? So the language is training you for a particular reality. It's adapting to that reality, right? So we're seeing these kinds of effects, and this is still all very, very early on, of grammar of languages being related to social environmental factors. The general hypothesis is that these particular languages are helping us cope with specific environments. And right, so, in a way, because humans are cultural animals and there's so much information that's being transmitted culturally, not just through language, but through other means, you have a case of the grammar of the language offering a particularly effective way of highlighting specific differences that may be important to that community. And so by now doing these kinds of analysis, we can actually see whether it holds on a large scale. Right, so, sorry I ran a bit long, but thank you for your attention. Take care.